It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up in just a few minutes, our guest shares the secret history of the nuclear weapons era, which is still going on right now. First, Governor Evers has ordered the U.S. and Wisconsin flags to be flown at half-staff today in honor of the victims of yesterday's mass shooting at the Molson Coors facility in Milwaukee. Police say a 51-year-old male employee opened fire at around 2 p.m., killing five other workers before taking his own life. All of the shooting victims died. No one else was injured. At a news conference last night, Mayor Tom Barrett said yesterday was the saddest day in the brewery's 165 years in the area known as Miller Valley.
The families are grieving. The union brothers and sisters are grieving. Our city is grieving. And our state is grieving. This cowardless act of violence is something that we have to make sure is never repeated in this community. But unfortunately, it is far too common in our country.
The Molson Coors campus remains closed today. CEO Gavin Hattersley said it would stay closed, quote, for the time being. Corinne Hess is Wisconsin Public Radio reporter in Milwaukee. Corey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You talked with people, I understand, who lived near the alleged perpetrator. We'll be watching for details, of course, in our news breaks. But what kind of things did you hear?
Well, I heard a lot of shock and sadness when I walked around the neighborhood today. Neighbors really like this this man who is being believed to be the shooter. They said that he was a good family man. They sort of have this pact in the neighborhood. Whoever wakes up first snowplows the sidewalk first. And this man was always one to wake up first and do the plowing. This is sort of a modest neighborhood with single-family ranch homes, and it's got a lot of older people that live there that have lived there for many decades, and they all really kind of appreciated the help that he would give them. So,
are police still investigating the scene or any other parts of the city related to the shooting?
They are. The police are there. There's tape up around the house. There's been a police car parked in the driveway. I was told that the police have been inside of the house since yesterday afternoon. This man's wife and young daughter have been asked to leave, and I'm not sure when they'll be able to return. So, yeah, there's an active investigation at the house.
As we heard, the Molson Coors facility closed for now. Local businesses and a nearby school were on lockdown yesterday. Are they back to normal operations today?
Yes, they are back to normal operations. I know Marquette High School is nearby, and a counselor spoke to students yesterday afternoon just because a lot of the students' parents worked or work at Miller Coors, so they wanted to make sure that students weren't afraid. Another WPR reporter has an interview in a few minutes with the guidance counselor over there, so we'll have some more information on that as well.
And we heard some of what Mayor Barrett had to say. What's been, in general, the tone of reaction that we're seeing so far from elected officials, community leaders, and others in the community?
You know, I would say just really shock and sadness. So everybody, you know, there's been 11 mass shootings in the state since 2004, and six people have died at a company in Milwaukee that's really a legacy company here, and I think a company that people know throughout the state. And so another thing that the mayor said yesterday were these were five individuals that went to work yesterday and planned on coming home. And they didn't. So, and also for the shooter, I mean, his family too has lost a person. So this is just a really hard time, I think, right now.
Corey, thanks for joining us. I'll let you get back to covering the story.
Thank you.
Corinne Hess is WPR Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Milwaukee. We talked to her about the latest developments in yesterday's mass shooting at the Molson Coors facility. Stay tuned to WPR News and WPR.org for more updates. Now we turn our attention to a secret history and a dilemma. How do the military and civilian leaders of a nation manage a new weapon after they've witnessed it as, quote, a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth? That quote from President Harry Truman, speaking after the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. That kicked off the era of nuclear weapons and debates among presidents and military leaders about how, when, and if we should use them. And it's an era that hasn't ended, even decades after the Cold War. Fred Kaplan is the national security columnist for Slate. He's the author of a number of books. His latest is called The Bomb Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War. Fred, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks.
Fred, the era where we were all scared of nuclear weapons, the duck and cover drills, the day after on TV, that's gone. But your book is a reminder the nuclear weapons era is still with us. Why do we have that disconnect, do you think?
Well, you know, for 30 years after the end of the Cold War, it seemed that the possibility of anybody using any of these things or any conflict serious enough for them to arise was off the books. I think things changed on August 8th of 2017 when President Trump came out of his golf clubhouse in New Jersey and said that if North Korea, continued to make threatening noises and tested missiles and nuclear devices, that we would unleash fire and fury on North Korea like the Earth had never seen. That's the first time any president has talked like that, especially not talking about what we would do in response to an attack, but in response to a country developing the ability to launch an attack. And all of a sudden, people got very nervous. But it was kind of a vague anxiety because it had been so long since we'd ever had to worry about this before. And in the case of people under a certain age, they'd never thought about it. So that's why I thought it would be useful to write this history spelling out where all of this stuff came from.
Going back to the beginning. Now, in my head, Fred, I always think of nuclear weapons. Everybody involved in the process looking on them as a last resort, a desperation measure. You write, no, a lot of the people who were establishing military doctrine surrounding nuclear weapons wanted to use them, big war, small war, whatever. Could you talk about that attitude?
Yeah, it's true. All through the 50s and into the early 60s, the policy of the United States, and by the way, we have always and still do have a policy of reserving the right to be the first to use nuclear weapons in a conflict. But the policy in the 50s and early 60s was that if the Soviet Union invaded Western Europe or occupied West Berlin, even if they did not use nuclear weapons first, the policy was to unleash our entire atomic arsenal against every target in the Soviet Union, the satellite nations of Eastern Europe, and even China. Even if China had no involvement in the war. And it was estimated that this would kill 285 million people. And, you know, this wasn't just some plan cooked up by crazy generals at Strategic Air Command in Omaha. This was a plan approved by the Joint Chiefs of Staff and by President Eisenhower.
When it comes to our nuclear arsenal, I think if you read some histories, there is this careful consideration of exactly what we need as a deterrence force, as a force to stop any retaliation from Russia and maybe China. A running theme through your book is that a lot of what we ended up spending money on had to do with bureaucratic turf wars among the leaders of the various military branches.
Yeah, especially early on, there was a big fight between the Air Force and the Navy, and I uncovered documents. In some cases, transcripts of tape recordings where the heads of the Navy is talking about the Air Force and the Air Force talking about the Navy in far harsher terms than they talked about the communists. They viewed each other as a mortal threat. Initially, the Air Force controlled the bomb with the B-52 bombers. Then the Navy came up with the Polaris submarine, which would be an invulnerable nuclear weapon, unlike the bombers, where you could attack the bases, you could attack missile sites. So yeah, the arms race in the beginning stage was as much a race between the Air Force and the Navy, at a time when really the Soviet missile force was stagnant, than it was between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. There's a lot of bureaucratic politics in all of these decision-making.
And a running question, again, for a number of years, maybe decades, is it possible to have a limited nuclear attack? Can we, say, just use nuclear weapons against Russian military targets? Can we be a little nuclear without spilling over into full-on nuclear war? Can you share some of the key points in that question?
Well, I mean, this was kind of a hope. I mean, you have to think back to, again, the 1960s. early 60s especially, it was assumed that there probably would be a war between the United States and the Soviet Union. It was then assumed that this war would probably go nuclear at some point. And there were some people who said, okay, can we do something besides this Strategic Air Command plan of just unleashing everything all at once? Because, see, by the early 60s, the dilemma was the Soviet Union started to develop their own nuclear arsenal that could hit us. So this threat of deterrence, where if they invade Western Europe, we'll clobber them with nukes, becomes a little less credible when they can clobber us right back with their own nukes. So people started thinking, can we maybe come up with some limited options? Maybe we just throw some weapons just to knock out their missiles, and maybe we can keep this thing controlled, keep it under wraps. But, you know, there was never any evidence, and still is no evidence, that the Russians think this way about nuclear war, that once you start unleashing even a little bit of this mayhem, that command control and communications start to break down. You really don't know what's going on the battlefield. I mean, you know the phrase fog of war. This would be a radioactive fog of war. And even people who have proposed these strategies for the best of intentions admitted when pressed that it was quite likely that things would escalate all the way once they get started.
There's reasoning at one point, if we have a restrained strike that only kills maybe 50 million in the Soviet Union, that will make it, well, they'll understand that we're holding back.
There was a restraint. In 1961, during the Berlin crisis, which is often forgotten in the shadow of the Cuban crisis, but it was in some ways even more serious, some officials did come up with a plan where with 88 weapons dropped by 44 bombers, we might, and there was the key phrase, might be able to completely destroy the Soviet nuclear force so they couldn't retaliate. But there was a caveat. This was a 33-page study that I got declassified that very detailed. There was a caveat, though, and that is, well, some of their weapons might survive, especially tactical weapons in Europe, and if they retaliated, millions of Americans and Western Europeans would get killed. So even with this overwhelming superiority that we had at the time, it was no magic ring. It was no magic bullet. You still faced the kind of catastrophic destruction and death that had been undreamed of in decades and eons past.
We're talking to Slate's national security columnist Fred Kaplan about his new book, The Bomb, Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions you have for our guest about nuclear weapons and American policy on the use or non-use of them? Do you want to share your memories, personal or through an older relative, about what it was like to live with what seemed like the very imminent threat of nuclear war? What thoughts do you have on nuclear weapons today, 2020? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Fred Kaplan stays with us. His latest book is The Bomb, Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about U.S. policy toward nuclear weapons from the beginning to today? Do you have hopes that nuclear weapons can come off the table in the U.S. and around the world? What do you think it would take to get there? Call 800-642-1234. Go to your calls. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I had been reading this book by Rick Wilson about the president, and in there he makes a reference to them, the president, and I think Rex Tillerson was there, and they're in this room called the tank with all the generals.
Mm-hmm.
Trump proposed that he wanted to increase the nuclear arsenal by tenfold.
Well, that's...
Have you ever heard of that?
Fred,
well,
you
that's
tell
actually
that story,
in my
yeah.
book. That's actually in my book. What happened was they showed him a chart of nuclear weapons over time. And, you know, the peak was in 1969 when we had 32,000 nuclear weapons. Now we have less than one-tenth that number. And the idea of this chart was to show, you know, the value of arms control treaties and the fact that dangerous as the world is, it's more stable than it used to be. But that's not how President Trump saw it. He pointed to the peak and he said, how come I can't have as many nuclear weapons as those presidents did? And it was explained to him that, you know, you really don't need them. And if we started building that many, people would think we were on course to launch a first strike and they would match us. And he took it okay. But then a couple weeks later, he was talking with his national security advisor in the White House, and he remembers his chart again. And he says, how come I can't have as many nuclear weapons as that president did? And the point is, and this is, you know, the longest chapter in this book is about the Trump years, and the second longest chapter is about the Obama years. So this isn't just a book about ancient history, but my observation about Trump is that he doesn't really look into the details of national security needs. It's pomp and drama. He likes a parade. You know, one theme of this book is that almost all of our presidents have gotten into crises in which the serious use of nuclear weapons has been contemplated. And in each of these cases, the presidents have immersed themselves deeply in the logic, in the strategy, in the scenarios, in the consequences, guided by briefers who discuss these things in a very calm, rational way. And in the end, they have all come to the conclusion that, no, I'm not going there. It's too risky, and they scramble out of the rabbit hole and try to come up with a diplomatic solution to the crisis as quickly as possible. And I just don't see this kind of deliberative trait in our current president.
You and some members of Congress, you write, and this was in the news a while back, members of Congress saying, hey, wait a minute. Do we really want to put all this control over our nuclear arsenal in the hands of one person, maybe in the hands of this particular person?
Yeah, there was a hearing. It wasn't covered much at the time. It was public. It was open. I watched it on C-SPAN 3. It was the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. It was the first time that Congress had held a hearing on this subject since the mid-1970s. And they came away, and in one part, you can get a transcript of this hearing. At one moment, a Democratic senator said, look, the reason we're having this hearing, let's be frank, is because we have a president who's reckless, poor judgment, who might get us into a war. This was around the peak time of the fire and fury period. Not a single Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee challenged this premise. It was concluded in this hearing that, yeah, the president, it's up to him. He can do this all by himself if he wants. But then afterwards, Congress did nothing about this. And one of the people testifying, it was a retired general named Robert Kaler, who had been the commander of Strategic Command right before this. And he came away from the hearing very frustrated because, as far as he's concerned, hey, if Congress wants to change the launch authority, especially for a first strike, not a response to a strike, that's up to them. They can do it. But what you should not do is to publicly question, raise doubts about the reliability and legitimacy of the command structure, and then not do anything about it. And that's what Congress did. And, you know, that's what Congress tends to do. They, you know, not except for a few years after passage of the War Powers Act in the 1970s, Congress just doesn't want to take responsibility for things. They put it all on the president and hammer him if things go badly and try to bask in his shadow when they go well. But on something like this, where there really should be some kinds of checks and balances, they have abdicated their role.
Thanks for the call, Willem. We're talking to Fred Kaplan about his new book, The Bomb, Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War. Back to your calls. Marcus is with us in Oregon. Marcus, hi.
Hey, guys, I just wanted to put a little personal experience here. I was living in Hawaii on Maui at the time a few years ago that we got alerts on our phone.
Right, right.
Regarding the incoming ballistic missile. And, you know, we all actually thought that we might die. I mean, at first we thought it was a prank or a hack. No, we actually, there's a moment in time that we thought we might die due to nuclear war and an incoming ballistic missile. Mm-hmm. And after the 40 minutes had passed, my takeaway was why do people allow the leaders, any leaders, whether it's India or Pakistan or the U.S. or Russia, two leaders possibly could ruin it for every one of us.
Marcus, no, thanks for that call. In our last couple minutes, Fred tackled that question for us.
Well, no, that's exactly the point. And, you know, there have been many instances, more than most people know, of situations where, in the case he talked about in Hawaii, it was a computer glitch, where either due to a computer glitch or to just a radar malfunction, you know, a flock of geese being mistaken for a flock of missiles, it looks like, you know, missiles are coming our way. And in some of those instances, it has only been because, say in one case, a Russian lieutenant colonel who looked at the radar screen, saw missiles coming, decided on his own authority that, nah, this can't be right. I'm not going to tell my superiors. You know, they might have saved the world by doing that. So, yeah, these things are subjected to... Here's my ultimate take, and it's from the last page of the book. You know, we've gotten away with not having a war, which was kind of a miracle, due to partly because nuclear deterrence works generally, but partly because we've had very shrewd leaders, and partly because we've had good luck. The real concern is what happens if you have a combination of a slow-witted leader and something like what the caller was calling about what would happen in Hawaii, is some spate of bad luck. That's the real concern of how things could go wrong.
Fred, thanks again for joining us today.
Sure, thank you.
That's Slate national security columnist Fred Kaplan. We talked to him today about his latest book. It's called The Bomb, Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War. Coming up after the news, our guest explains why he says UW-Madison's bias response team could be creating, he says, an Orwellian environment on the campus. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the latest Marquette Law School poll is out. We'll learn where people stand on issues like health policy and the 2020 presidential candidates. First, our next guest says UW-Madison's program to deal with incidents of bias and hate may be causing George Orwell to stir in his grave. Since 2016, if people feel that another student, faculty, or staff member said or did something they think is biased or insensitive, they can submit what's called a bias incident report form. According to a recent story in the Dispatch, 107 bias or hate complaints were made in the 2018-2019 school year. Donald Downs is the Alexander Michael John Professor of Political Science Emeritus and Affiliate Professor of Law and Journalism Emeritus at UW-Madison. His new book, Free Speech and Liberal Education, A Plea for Intellectual Diversity and Tolerance, came out this week. Donald, thanks for joining us today.
Sure thing, Rob. Glad to be aboard.
Well, can you talk about the original intent of this bias incident report process?
Well, the original intent is to get a sense of what kind of acts of discrimination are going on campus. And those can include certain forms of verbal conduct, such as harassment, and things of that nature, which has a pretty specific meaning according to the Supreme Court. The problem is that if you talk about insensitive remarks and those get reported, insensitivity is an incredibly broad term. And simply, you know, disagreeing with somebody's political candidate could be seen as insensitive. So the concern is the overreach.
What happens when a complaint is filed? What are the consequences?
Well, apparently, from my knowledge, I mean, first of all, we need to realize this is a nationwide kind of system. there are at least 232 schools that have it, but I'm sure the number's really larger than that. That's how many have reported having it. And some schools have treated the process much better than other schools. And to my knowledge, UW-Madison has not sanctioned anybody. They have called people in to talk to them about the complaints. And then the question is how that's handled, and I don't really have an answer to that right now.
What is your concern about a reporting system like this done, as far as we know, the way UW-Madison is doing it?
Well, the concern is if students report comments that have intellectual content related to the class that and they don't like what the professor has said, they can kind of spin that in a way which could have a real chilling effect on honest discourse in the class. And it's one thing to have the program have a standard of harassment and discriminatory speech that conforms to First Amendment standards, which ours does, to UW-Madison's credit. But if students don't abide by that and they file complaints about comments that are made as part of the normal give and take of intellectual discourse, it could have a real chilling effect on speech, and faculty members and students will feel like there's a kind of a Damocles sword hanging over their head where they can be informed upon simply for saying something someone else doesn't like or finds insensitive.
On the UW bias,
there's that kind of Orwellian consequence that can happen.
On the bias or hate reporting website at UW-Madison, it adds this to the definition of bias. I'm quoting here: although the expression of an idea or point of view may be offensive or inflammatory to some, it is not necessarily a violation of law or university policy. The university values and embraces the ideals of freedom of inquiry, freedom of thought, and freedom of expression, all of which must be vitally sustained in a community of scholars. So, I mean, translating, it sounds like you may feel it was insensitive. We may not agree with you, even though you report this. So does that mollify your concerns at all?
Well, it certainly mollifies it. And I should admit that I was partly involved in getting that standard put in there, working with the administration. So I think it's very good that that's there. And as a matter of fact, that standard has gotten a green light from FIRE, which is a national organization, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, which gives different red light for a policy that violates the First Amendment clearly, a yellow light, the one that has potential to do that, but doesn't really on its face, and a green light means that it's First Amendment friendly. And the Madison program does have a green light from FIRE. And we did work on that to make that happen with the cooperation of the administration. So that's very good. The problem is if the way it's being applied in practice, and so the relationship between the administration and the professors who have complaints against them, if those aren't done in the right way, it can have a real chilling effect. So a lot depends on how these things are applied when the rubber hits the road. And that's where the concern would be. But at least as it's written, the Madison standard is very good, and that's to the administration's credit.
Talking to Donald Downs, a UW-Madison emeritus professor, author of the new book, Free Speech and Liberal Education, A Plea for Intellectual Diversity and Tolerance. We're talking about a policy, a program at UW-Madison, a bias incident report form. If UW-Madison came back to you, Donald, and said, okay, how can we make sure we're doing the policy right when these things are reported and the kind of things we're looking for, what would you say to them?
Well, and as a matter of fact, they have reached out to me already just because of the op-ed that appeared. And, you know, I know people over there, Ray Tafora, who's the lead legal counsel for UW-Madison. He and I have worked together over the years on these issues. So I have, you know, faith in him to do it right. What I would like to see, leave it like it used to be, where if somebody commits an act of sexual harassment, racial harassment, et cetera, based upon the legal standard, that, you know, you go to the chair of the department, you can report that. That's been going on for many, many years. But this is a special program which seems to encourage people to file complaints if remarks simply bother them too much. And that's where the real danger can lie. So I would rather see that system done away with and just rely on the old system, make sure the old system's working, or at least screen some of these complaints and only bring the professors in when, according to the administration, there clearly is a problem here that needs to be worked out. As is, I have one professor contacted me who was called in for a student complaint, which is really just utterly off the wall. And he felt that he was being looked at in a kind of a picky way, in a way which sort of chilled his speech in class. So I'd like to see more screening going on. Separate the serious complaints from the non-serious complaints.
What about in a system where you rely on that department chair? What if they are the subject of the complaint or perceived as sympathetic to the subject of the complaint? Is there a workaround for that situation?
Well, yes, usually there are. I mean, departments have different people that deal with these things. And I know when I was in political science, usually the first thing you do is go to the chair, and the chair then would talk to delegate a committee or someone else in the department to look into the matter. And that could be done in the kind of case you're talking about. These kinds of processes have been in play for a long time. And why do you need a new program that encourages the kind of example that I used in my op-ed that came out of that research done by the reporter for Dispatch, where a professor simply said, so there's certain sacred cows that we're afraid to challenge. And the next thing you know, by using the term sacred cow, he's accused of white supremacy by the student. I mean, that's a pretty serious charge for simply using a term that we use all the time.
Now, you've got a whole book out about this, and I imagine we'll probably talk to you about the new book at some point. But put this in the context of what you're seeing going on around the country. What has you concerned enough to say to write a new book about free speech and liberal education?
Well, because programs like this have proliferated around the country, it's really been going on, beginning with the speech code movement back in the 1990s that I talked about in the op-ed, where a lot of schools passed speech codes to try to regulate speech that people considered offensive. And a lot of those codes were declared unconstitutional. It led to all sorts of problems, people feeling they're walking on eggshells in class, not afraid to speak their minds with intellectual honesty. And these new kinds of programs, like the bias reporting system, are kind of end runs around the speech codes that were declared unconstitutional in many cases to try to kind of get more surveillance and more control over what people say in class. And if it's not done right, which is often the case, it can really interfere with, you know, intellectually honest debate and discussion about very sensitive issues.
Let's bring on a caller now. Charles is with us in Eau Claire. Charles, hi.
Hi. So I'm a student at UW-Eau Claire, and freshman year, they have all the students go through this online training course about sexual harassment. And I was curious if our guest would be in favor of such an online course that would properly train students or staff about how to properly report sexual, or not sexual bias, but bias and hate statements.
Well, I mean, training when it comes to what constitutes sexual harassment and these other issues that have legal standing there and do not qualify for freedom of speech, I think is certainly valid. Everybody needs to know what sexual harassment is and what lines they should never cross. And so if the training is done in a straightforward kind of way, that's just a thing that universities should do. The problem is when you start expanding it to discourse in general and say, you know, you should never offend anybody for what they say, then you're really interfering with the process of intellectual discussion, which takes place not only in the classroom, but all over campus, and makes for a vibrant intellectual environment. So, you know, basic training in this stuff is fine, and as a matter of fact, necessary, but it should not be browbeating. It should be, you know, straightforward and say what the rules are. And two, it should be clear that speech that people just find upsetting and irritating or overly challenging should not be considered forms of hate speech or harassment.
Charles, thanks for that call. And Donald, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
Donald Downs is a professor of political science emeritus and affiliate professor of law and journalism emeritus at UW-Madison. He's also the author of the new book, Free Speech and Liberal Education, A Plea for Intellectual Diversity and Tolerance. Talk to him about UW-Madison's bias response team. Coming up, we'll get the latest results and analysis of the Marquette Law School poll. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there are a lot of ways an election can go wrong, from foreign interference to local mismanagement and beyond. An elections expert shares some meltdown scenarios on voting day and how to prevent them. First, the Marquette Law School released its latest poll of Wisconsin voters today. The poll asked 1,000 registered voters statewide about their thoughts on the field of Democratic presidential hopefuls and whether their opinions have swayed at all as we get closer to the April primary. Plus, there were federal issues. They asked about trade, health policy, and the end of the impeachment process, and issues closer to home, the state budget, property taxes, and more. Charles Franklin is professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. He's also co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here. Thank you.
big national news here, the Democratic primary. What are you seeing when you ask people in Wisconsin who they are supporting in this primary field?
Well, we've seen some real shifts since voting began in Iowa and New Hampshire. Bernie Sanders is in first place at 29% of Democratic primary voters. That's up 10 points from where he was a month ago. Mike Bloomberg has also moved up a lot to 17 points and in second place, but that's an 11-point bump for him. He was in single digits in January. Finally, Joe Biden has stepped down a bit to 15%, which puts him in third place. That's down 8 points from a month ago. Biden had been in first place in each of our polls from August through January, so a real move for him now that voting has started. The other notable move is probably that Elizabeth Warren, who had been contending for second place earlier in the year, has slipped down to sixth of the top six Democrats, down to 9 percentage points. That's a 5-point drop for her from a month ago.
And that looks like Senator Sanders, it matches this national narrative that he is the front runner based on votes and polls around the country.
Certainly it's a bump for him, and it's a pretty solid lead, a 12-point lead over Bloomberg and 14 points over Biden. You know, I caution that there's a lot moving right mm-hmm. now. This is reflecting the changes that took place because we had, you know, one caucus and one primary. And we're going to have a whole lot of caucuses and primaries over the next month. So expect to see changes and not necessarily who we expect to do well or do poorly. That's the whole point of the surprises of the contest. But I think this month's results compared to last does show how much potential there is for some candidates to move up or others to move down.
You also did what they call head-to-heads, each of the main Democratic candidates and how they stack up against President Trump in Wisconsin. What do we see there?
There we see the same very close races that we saw before, though the order of candidates is just a little bit different. This month, Sanders does best against Trump, 48-46. I want to say up front, those are all inside the margin of error, which is about 3.6 percentage points. Then we have three Democrats tied with President Trump. Biden and Buttigieg and Klobuchar are all tied at either 46 or 45%. Then Bloomberg trails Trump by 1 point. And finally, Elizabeth Warren trails by 3 points. So that's an improvement for Sanders, who was up by 1 point last month. So it's not much movement, but a little bit. And a little bit down for Biden, who was ahead by 4 last month and is now tied this month.
Now, people who follow this stuff, Charles, may have noticed this. I think it was Quinnipiac did a poll looking at battleground mm-hmm. states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Minnesota, was it? Or Michigan. But anyway, the key thing was the mm-hmm. other states Democrats are looking good in. Here in Wisconsin, according to this one poll, Donald Trump was running away with this.
Yeah.
What's up there?
Well, we've had three polls in the last week, which is a really good opportunity for people to look at the range of results. And it's easy to say, well, they don't agree. But on the other hand, it shows you how uncertain you should be about this. Quinnipiac showed Trump leading by between 7 and 11 points, I believe, against all the Democrats. UW-Madison came out with a poll on Sunday, which showed tight races with Democrats just a little bit ahead, but inside the margin of error, I think, in most of the cases. And now my results show a split with Sanders a little ahead, Trump a little ahead of Warren, and a very close race with the others either tied or Bloomberg down by 1. This is consistent with what my polling has shown all year, that sometimes Trump is a little bit ahead. Sometimes Democrats are a little bit ahead. Virtually all of it has been inside the margin of error. And one of the things we're really seeing is just how deep the party polarization is, which is not changing people's minds between Trump and any Democrats. But we've seen a lot of change in the Democratic primary among the Democrats. So the change is within the party, not in the November head-to-head against President Trump.
Now, here's something that seems striking to me anyway. You look at favorable, unfavorable ratings for a lot of these Democratic candidates, and they're underwater, higher disapproval than approval. Right. President Trump came out even, which is significant this time, too. But then those head-to-heads come out pretty even. Is this a case where, and I'm just making up a guess here, Democratic primary people are angry at everybody but their candidates, but maybe they'll come together after the primaries? Who knows? What do you make of it?
Yeah, I think that's basically right. I'm not sure if it's angry or just, not excited. But whereas Republicans are almost completely united in how much they dislike any of the Democrats, we're seeing between 15 and 25% of Democrats saying they have an unfavorable view of some of the Democratic candidates, or virtually all of them. And a lot of that is your first place candidate, the candidate you're backing, is getting a 95% favorability. But the people you're not backing, boy, those numbers can be down as low as maybe 50% unfavorable if you're not backing this candidate and you really don't like them. So Democrats are more divided. That'll probably, ease as a nominee emerges, because normally parties do unify. And the degree to which Democrats don't like Trump and Republicans don't like the Democrats is going to mean that the parties almost surely unify. But right now, the gap between favorability of Democrats and favorability of Trump is very heavily driven because Democrats are a bit divided.
Looking at the new Marquette Law School poll with Charles Franklin. Closer to home, you ask about a lot of issues, Charles, and a lot of the numbers seem to break down in a partisan way. But how about the way we draw our district boundaries in the state? Redistricting, we call it. Gerrymandering, people call it. What do we see when we ask people about that?
Yeah, 20% say they prefer the governor and the legislature to draw those lines. 70% would rather have a nonpartisan commission. That's essentially the same numbers as we saw in January of 2019. So not much change there. Here's a good example that very large majorities for an issue don't necessarily mean that policy change will take place on that issue. We've seen that on guns as well, where red flag laws and background checks have over 80% support, but legislation doesn't move despite that.
Any other issues that stuck out to you among the ones you asked about, Charles, in our last couple of minutes?
I would say a side point is there's more variety in the issue positions than there is in the candidate choices in the head-to-head contest. And that does show us that there's some variability. There are a lot of Republicans that would like nonpartisan redistricting, for example. The things I would hit is probably that Medicare for All is supported by 46 and opposed by 51. But a public option in which the government would have a plan you could voluntarily buy into gets 61% in favor, 32% opposed. So that's an issue on the national front. Finally, on trade, free trade issues, 64% favor free trade, 21% are opposed. That's actually gone up despite the partisan debates we've had over the last 4 years about free trade.
In our last minute or so, getting back to the presidential race, Charles, what are you watching for after Super Tuesday? Is the sifting and winnowing, as we say in Wisconsin, going to change things a lot over the next few weeks?
I'm sure that things will change a lot. It would be really surprising if by the end of March we aren't down to maybe just two candidates or possibly three. That'll change things a lot. One thing we found in this poll is electability matters more than favorable or unfavorable attitudes within the Democratic Party. Some of the best-liked candidates are trailing in the vote, and some of the less-liked candidates are at the top. It really looks like it follows electability rather than following favorability.
Charles, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director there of the Marquette Law School poll. He's also co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. He joined us today to talk about the latest poll results. They asked Wisconsin voters about the 2020 Democratic candidates, how they stack up against President Trump in a re-election campaign, health policy, state issues, and more. You can share your thoughts on the surveys and what they say. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Here's a weird footnote in music history I stumbled across. Today is the 40th anniversary of the first ever Grammy Award for Best Disco Recording. Today is also the 40th anniversary of the last ever Grammy Award for Best Disco Recording. As reported at history.com, disco music was big in the late 1970s, but the Grammys were a little slow to acknowledge the genre. Finally, 1980, they get around to giving it its own category, just in time for a nationwide backlash against disco music. So in 1981, the disco category disappeared. But disco artists and fans had the last laugh. It ended up influencing pop, dance, and electronic music to this day. A lot of throwback disco fans out there, even in 2020. As Gloria Gaynor, the only winner of the Grammy Award for Best Disco Recording, might say, disco will survive.
Many nights thinking how you did me wrong, and I grew strong, and I learned.